So, we are working toward the senses. That is to say, the theme that we have is the feel of sensing. And I think it's becoming increasingly clear that where the reading takes us and where TSK takes us in this particular respect is the senses, engaging the senses in a radically different way. That really would be the aim. I think we don't know yet exactly, but we're beginning to get an idea where that would take us. And of course, the guiding principle that we're using to go toward that radically different way of engaging the senses is the field. So when we started the sequence of classes, we were talking about our ordinary way of using the senses and kind of focused on the idea that so often we hardly really even are aware of the world around us. We're not using our senses in a very open way, because in fact what we're doing is labeling experience. And that is a thought that will be familiar to people who've worked with TSK. It's also a thought that'll be familiar, I think, from a lot of different spiritual traditions or traditions that work with embodiment, that we don't let ourselves really come in contact with our experience because we interpose this layer of meaning. And so the first exercise that we did, and I'm reviewing here because I think it's good to keep the kind of the coherence of what we're doing so that people can keep that sense of momentum. I think there is a momentum to what we're doing. When we started, we were working with the idea that you could strip away the identity of what it is that you experience, what you see, what you hear, what you touch or taste. Usually people work with seeing and hearing because we're seeing and hearing beings. That's, 90%, it seems like, of what we do. We're working with the senses and stripping away the identity of the senses, and that's a way you could say of really coming in contact with the senses in a more pure way. It's also a kind of a preliminary move in terms of what we're doing in this program or where we're headed. It's like, okay, I can come more into contact with the world, and of course, in conventional terms, the way we often try to do that is through art, through music, through the visual arts, and so on. But however we do it, and we did some practices along those lines, however we do it, we want to come in contact with sense experience more directly. Now what? What's the next move? And we started to talk about that really a couple of classes ago, and it has to do with connecting with the field. And the basic idea here is that the way we use our senses is a it, it depends on a certain field of possibilities. One way to think about that is in terms of the subject seeing objects or hearing objects or touching objects. You say, okay, there's a subject and an object, but even more fundamental than that, there is a field that supports the appearance of objects and supports the knowing of the subject. And that's the kind of field awareness that we're talking about developing. So The reading, you know, what this chapter does, and we started talking about this last week because we read the first part of the chapter, but we didn't really go through the whole reading during our phone call last week, so I want to backtrack a little bit. What this chapter does is start to look at the field in terms of time and space and knowledge. So what are the time, space, and knowledge that operate in the field? And the question is going to be, how does that then connect us back to the possibility of a radical transformation of sense experience? So Rinpoche talks about time and he talks about space. It's a very condensed discussion. It's on page 377, and this was actually the reading for next week. I see a note from Ari that there's a technical problem. I don't know if it's at this end, so hopefully Kathleen can deal with it. I will not try to deal with it. So he talks in a very condensed way about time and space, and I want to go into that, especially because we did a practice last week. I suggested a practice, and I guess we did it too in the phone call, and I want to do it again this week. That has to do with space. But let's look quickly at time. He says, when we work with time, he says, you know, there's a typical way to perceive time. That's at the bottom of page 376. And it's typical in this, what the word typical here means really that it is that it arises within a field. So the typical way to deal with time has to do with the nature of what he calls between. In other words, things happen, if you're talking temporally, you'd say, you know, between this moment and the next moment, right? Or between this experience and the next experience. And the possibilities for knowledge, the possibility for awareness, the possibilities for sensing, all really depend on making this distinction. There's this one moment and then there's another moment, and that's how, you know, based on that structure, we say, okay, well, now I'm feeling or experiencing or sensing this, now I'm feeling or experiencing or sensing that, something changed. That's the structure, and it's really, really basic. I mean, it's very hard to imagine how you could do it any other way. Well, he doesn't give us any clues here. He just makes that point. So we're going to move on. We're not going to do anything with time, but I wanted to raise the possibility. Excuse me. Then he talks about space, and there's only one paragraph about space, and it was the foundation for the exercise that we did, which was a shortened version of an exercise taken from earlier in the book. And as I say, I want to have us do that again now. I'm just trying to give us a little background for it. So he says, let's see, let's just look at the paragraph. With regard to space, knowledge sees this, that is, sees space, as the domain in which objects appear. So you've got a field, you've got objects in the field, you've got knowledge, you've got a possibility for knowing in the field, and space, if you look at it in terms of that field, is just the domain in which objects appear. Okay. Confirming through their appearance the directionality of time and the truth of derivation. I'm not going to say anything about that. Objects in space derive their shape and form from antecedent circumstances and conditions and from their interrelationships. Again, this is really, really basic stuff in the sense that it just seems fundamental to the way our experience is, and it's very difficult to imagine how it could be any other way. Okay. Though space as such is free from properties and characteristics, that is, you know, what we typically say about space is that it's nothing at all, it shelters objects and events, allowing their origination, sustaining their characteristics, making them available for interaction, and assuring their continued existence. In other words, all the things that we take for granted about objects depends on a certain way of understanding what's possible for space. So the exercise that we did last week and that I want us to do now has to do with questioning that relationship between space and objects. And the way we do that is by, at least the way we start to do that, is by looking at the place, the edge of an object, and recognizing that that's also an edge of empty space, right? So what the exercise says is, it says reflect on the difference between space and what it contains. And the word reflection may be a little bit misleading. It's really asking you to kind of meditatively enter into the space quality at the edge of the object. Now, there's also, of course, the space that the object occupies. And if you meditatively reflect on or engage the space at the edge of the object, you may also find yourself naturally drawn into the space that the object occupies. So Sudaba in the chat section asks, is that the same thing as talking about the way that space accommodates? Yes, basically it is. And you know, usually we say space contains. That's kind of our typical way of talking about space. And Rinpoche very often prefers to say that space is not so much a container, but it's an accommodating field. And you know, that's something to explore, but we don't have to explore it right now. The exercise that we're doing is a way of going to that accommodating dimension, but you don't have to really worry about, you know, what that means. We want a kind of a focus to our reflection or meditation, and that focus is the edge between the object and the space that contains the object. At least that's the starting point. And as the exercise on page 188 of Knowledge of Time and Space that we looked at, as it says, when you do that, you begin to recognize that each object is a kind of marriage, that's the word it uses, of space and existence. And it's not as though we have to accept that claim, but it's an interesting clue as to how we might approach this. You know, there's space and there's the object, and if you go to the edge, there's something interesting to be seen there. And this image of a marriage is one way to look at that. So we did that last week. Maybe you've been doing it during the week, but I'd like to come back again to do that practice. And it's a simple, straightforward practice, picking out an object and going to the edge of the object, which is also the edge of space. You might also try looking at, you know, two or three objects at the same time, you know, in your field of vision, and seeing how space connects them or is different from all of them. That's the basic practice. So let's do that for a few minutes, and then we can talk about it, talk about your experience, and then we'll move on from there. So I'm going to take myself out of video, and we'll do the practice for a few minutes. Okay, let's come back together. So before we did the practice, Sudaba asked a question about space accommodation. That might be one place to start looking. In the practice, or before we did the practice, I suggested you might look at several objects at once. So my question for you, as always, is just what did you notice? What did you discover? What kinds of questions came up for you? And I think I'm going to start, but I'm happy to hear from other people, or of course in the chat. I'm just going to make an observation that struck me that had to do with this idea of looking at several different objects. One of the characteristics of the way we do this is that we're tied to our computers. So in my case, well, maybe, or your phone. In my case, I'm sitting at a desk, and looking at my desk, it seemed very crowded. And I started, that is, there were a lot of objects on the desk. And I started thinking about what that meant. So where does the crowding come from? What does that mean to say that it's crowded? And if I looked at each object in terms of its relationship to the space around it, I couldn't find any crowding. It seemed like each object was taking up just exactly the right amount of space. And it didn't really have to worry about the other objects around it. I suppose maybe crowding has to do with my own relationship to the objects. If I have to reach out for one, I have to avoid the others, and so on. But it was just striking to me that a notion like crowding is kind of arbitrary. It doesn't have anything to do with the space of the object, which is very accepting, Just find the way it is. Okay, I'm going to look at a couple of the comments that people have put into the chat area. So David says, opening to the direct experience. Okay, I'm sorry, I wasn't reading that right. He's referring back to the notion that when you strip away the label and you open to the experience, then that seems to create a more expanded awareness. And he's saying that, like that, when you focus on the edge of the object, there's a kind of an expanded knowing. So there's a kind of a sense, a discovery, or David, noticed something about how meaning gets assigned. And also how how the space is bounded by the limit of the thoughts, the things that we know. I'm just going to read what he says about imagination. I'll read a little more. He says, how space is bounded by limits of thought forms, the things I know about the objects in space. My imagination is in play regarding the interior space. I'm not sure, David, if you mean the interior space of the chair that you were looking at or your interior. But okay, my imagination is in play regarding the interior space, the air, the forgiving seat, the comfort. So that's interesting. The sense of comfort comes with the chair that you're looking at. So it's a comfortable chair, I guess. And the question is that a quality of space that it's comfortable? Is it a quality of the field? That begins to make a little more sense, right? The feel of the field in which you discovered a certain quality like comfort is you in relation to that chair, or you in relation to the possibilities of that chair, you in relation to what that chair offers you. That's the way people, Western philosophers, like to talk about that sometimes. Okay, I'm going to move on. There's several comments here, so please feel free to comment to each other or respond to your comments or speak up. Of course, those of you who are actually live on microphone. So Tina's saying that the various objects have different feels to them. So there's the trees moving in the wind, which feels fluid, and then there's a house which feels more solid. I that's kind of related for me to what I was saying about the fact that objects are not crowded on my desk. They take up the space that's appropriate to them. So a house is there in a very solid way. And trees are there. The branches of the trees are there in a very different way. And if we think about the question of space, we can say, or the qualities of space that the field allows, you can say, okay, space allows this very solid quality, but it also allows a very fluid and flowing quality. Are those qualities of space? Is that something that space allows, but it doesn't belong to space? Those are questions to explore. Okay, Caroline says that space feels more powerful than the objects. And there's also a sense of inner space in the act of seeing and the space around and interconnecting the object. That's good. I think these are the ways that we're looking at the possibilities for the field. So, let's turn this for a moment to the question of sensing, because of course when you look at an object, and mostly people are reporting on looking at objects, which is natural, that's what we mostly do. When you look at an object, the sense of seeing is in operation, and by focusing on the field, and which you can do by focusing on space and the edges of objects, you discover really that the field is it engages a lot of aspects of our experience that we don't normally think of as sense experience, or we don't maybe in the abstract we might, but if we actually look at the experience, we begin to discover more of these dimensions. So, the sense excuse me, the sense of inner space in the act of seeing, the fluid feel that Tina referred to. And if I go back up for a moment to what David said about his imagination being in play, and so there's the air, there's the seat, there's the sense of comfort. There's a kind of maybe I want to say a thread running through experience, but it's not excuse me. It's not just a thread. I mean, that's a very narrow thing. It's the feel of the field, and space gives access to the feel of the field, and then you could say to the feel of sensing. Take a look at what Bruce said. Openness, clarity, and depth. That's what stood out for him. And with respect to depth, okay, that's interesting. He says, I noticed I had to establish the feel of depth in order to contact space as the container for objects. That makes a lot of sense. Depth is a dimension that we usually assign to space. We're talking about physical space to begin with. We're picking out an object in space. And so there are going to be issues like location and distance and separation of one object from another. And the most natural way to make sense out of that is in terms of what do you say? Height and breadth and depth, I guess. But depth does seem to have a special quality, doesn't it? It's when we think about depth, when we it has a kind of a meaning to us to say that something is deep. I mean, you can divorce that from the physical sense very easily. And as soon as we get a sense of depth, that shifts things. An experience that feels deep is a very different kind of experience. So, okay, Bruce is saying he had to establish that field of depth even just to get into contact with the sense of space as a container, and then that led him also to the mental and physical qualities of space and what I was just saying. Bruce put much more nicely, really. Depth is a kind of an interpretation, a mental distinction. I guess maybe it's an interesting question to ask. Is depth, yes, depth you could say is an interpretation. Is it more than that if we think of interpretations as being labels, because there seems to be something fundamental in the sense of space that has to do with depth. Okay. And then Bruce writes, thinking about fields, I had a sense of space emerging or embodying the interplay of mental and sensory activity. So that's interesting, that space might embody that interplay, and that space would embody is not a concept that we usually work with, but or think about. But it makes some sense. And one of the nice things, I mean, it's great to see all these descriptions that people are giving. Okay, let's take a look at what we have. A couple of other, gee, we have quite a few comments here. Very nice. So Shruti says, the concept of the boundary of objects is intriguing. An object such as a laptop, yes, I know, trees and chairs are wonderful, but I'm seeing a laptop in front of me. And then there's a phone and so on. Anyway, an object such as a laptop is distinct from the space around it, and its surface serves as a boundary between itself and space, but it's also in that space and inhabiting it. Yeah, exactly. That's really what we're looking at is, what does it mean? Something has an identity. That means it has a boundary. And we're talking about physical objects, but because we occupy a certain field in which there are physical objects, but there are also mental objects and people and so on, we tend to use the same styles of knowing, and the relationship between identity and boundary is something that is not only physical, but shows up throughout the field of knowing that is available to us. And I think that's one of the points we're looking at. So yes, the object has a surface. The surface is a boundary. The boundary separates the object from space, but it doesn't really, as you say, Shruti. It doesn't really, because it's also in that space and inhabiting the space. So it's very easy, it's very natural to say the boundary of the object separates it, but if you look more from the space dimension, that separation becomes less solid, because space is not broken up by objects. And that's another thing that becomes clear in doing this practice. Okay,
Can I say
Sudha,
something?
yeah, go ahead.
Michael, I was looking at a gold ring and the reflection of a lamplight off it. It occurred to me that the light is invisible, except for the surfaces it reflects off. In a way, it's what knits together for the sense of vision, at least. And it needs those surfaces, otherwise the world would be dark. It needs the surfaces. So in a way, that dimension of space providing a reflective surface is essential for most of our sense experience.
Yeah, I think that's very good. The relationship between light and objects and space, that kind of interplay, begins to point toward knowledge. And since we're coming to the end of our time, I think I want to turn towards knowledge. But let's just look at that specific point that you're making, Michael, at the very end of the reading, if I remember correctly. Let's see. Well, let's see. I guess it's not at the very end of the reading, but he talks about knowledge and lucency. That is the light quality of knowledge. I think that that's a great place to look. It's a little different from the exercise we were doing, but your example is a good one. If you look at something shiny, like a gold ring, then that connection comes in right away. Okay, I'm going to go back to just for a moment to Sudaba and Tina in the chat. What do you call that? The chat box. So our projections, looking at space helps us see more how we project onto space. And then there's the issue that Tina raises, or the point Tina makes, which is right, that seems to me that depth has to do with openness. So that's something to explore. Okay. I'm going to go ahead now and talk about the knowledge dimension, because that was actually what we did the reading on today. And Rinpoche makes a number of interesting points here. And I just want to make sure we're kind of on the same page with respect to that. So knowledge has to do with the field. And what he says at the top of page 378 is very specific about that. He says, knowledge arises in relationship to specific presuppositions regarding the characteristics of the subjective world, the field of thoughts or emotion-centered constructs. Now, it's interesting that he talks about the subjective world here. We've been focusing, because our focus is the senses, we've been focusing on the objective world, that is to say, the things that we encounter, laptops and trees and chairs and gold rings and so on. Here he's focusing on the subjective side. I think the reason for that is not because somehow the subjective is more important. Clearly the field allows for both, but because we think of knowledge as something that's related to the subjective realm. That is, we think of ourselves as being the ones who know. Right? But if you're looking at the field, and if you're looking at space and object, I think one of the things that begins to become clear is that knowledge or awareness, which is the word that Rinpoche usually uses here in this section here, I mean, he uses both, is, it starts off as a kind of subjectivity, but in fact, it pervades the field. It just has a particular form. The form that it has is the kind of knowledge that we are capable of. We as individual knowers are capable of. But it's something richer than that. That's the point that Rinpoche wants to make. And he says, in the first full paragraph on 378, he says, awareness is a readiness to respond. And then he says, once experience enters a specific field, awareness goes into action, processing what is given in somewhat the same way that the stomach digests food, which is a nice image. Okay, so we need to be a little careful here, I think. The capacity of awareness, the readiness to respond capacity of awareness, is not limited by the field. I'm just stating that, but I think if you read through what Rinpoche writes here, you will get the same idea. But in fact, what happens is that awareness always arises, at least in ordinary experience. It's one of the questions we want to ask, that awareness always arises in terms of a specific field. So you can say awareness is a readiness to respond, and that seems to suggest that awareness could go anywhere, do anything, have any qualities. But in fact, what happens is it enters a field, and that's what he said in the section we just looked at. And in the next paragraph, he goes on and he says, you can't say, it would be misleading to suggest that awareness is independent of the field. Right? And he says, if we look more closely, it seems difficult to conceive of a generic awareness active before the fields. It seems more accurate to say that fields are the determinants for awareness. And then he tries to, he runs that idea out for a while, trying to clarify exactly what he means. And you might want to go back and look. We had this for the reading, so maybe this is very clear already. But he's making this point about how awareness is affected by the field. In effect, we wake up, our awareness wakes up into a field. And he puts that in a very clear way at the top of page 379. He says, knowledge arises only when awareness and experience, that is the experience of something, right? Only when awareness and experience enter into partnership. It is as though one body had two personalities. Experience is within awareness, and awareness is within experience. You might ask, what's the difference between awareness and experience? Because we think of awareness, we think of experience rather, as something pretty much linked to subjective awareness. I mean, we talk about subjective experience, but I think here he's pointing out that yes, experience belongs to a self, but it's always experience of something. And that structure, I am experiencing this, that's the field into which awareness awakens. So there is a kind of knowing inherent in space, and that's what the exercise we did was exploring. And the only thing I want to add to that in terms of the reading is what I started to try to point to and couldn't find, but now I have it. In response to Michael's comment, which is that the space, the relationship between awareness and the experience of specific objects or specific subjective states, that relationship, which is what gives awareness its specific form in our field, is an expression of something more fundamental, and that's what Rinpoche talks about as being intrinsically lucent. So what he says here in the second full paragraph on page 379, he says, awareness can operate even when not acknowledged in any ordinary sense. And what that means then is that the standard rhythm, the standard way in which awareness takes form, it's not the only option, he says. So characteristics and labels that would normally lead to being aware of specific content can give way to a different form of knowing. That's really where we are. We would like to direct our inquiry, this different form of knowing, which, as he says here, is intrinsically lucent, right? And then he talks about how you could explore that possibility, and he's not it's not speculative, he said. Maybe we'll look at that again next week because we're out of time. But the idea here is that we don't have to be bound by the field. So I want to do something for next week, between now and our next session, and that is I'm going to post a description online taken from Sacred Dimensions of Time and Space that it's about space, and it's a much more poetic way of describing what we've been discussing here. And last week I said that in some ways you want to read this material as though it were more poetry than philosophy, let's say. And in this case, what I'm going to post about space is clearly more poetic. And then in the light of that, in the light of that reading, I'd like you to do the same exercise that we've been doing, the edges of space exercise. And I'm going to ask, I don't usually give assignments, but I'm going to ask that everybody post something online, and I'll do it too, about what that experience is like in the light of the reading, doing the exercise, just something about what your experience is like. And the kinds of things that people posted today in the chat box are fine. I'm not asking for polished essays, just something about what you discovered.